alayhi salam, but they like to eat at Muawiyah's.
Ah, it reminds me of another character.
Yes, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, Abu Huraira, who said this quite openly in his book. He did say that if I wanted the spiritual mirage of the moment, I would pray behind Imam Ali alayhi salam. But if I want the world, then I would have the gold of Mavia.
Right. And the point is, you can't have them all.
No, you can't. No.
You can't have them.
No, that's ridiculous.
Once you take
that is insanity. That's ludicrous.
The point is, once you take Mawiyah's gold...
Gold.
You're not going to go up to Miraj.
You're not going to go. That's right.
Even if you pray, you know, the whole night behind Imam Ali.
No, it's cancelled.
It's not going to get you.
Yes, it's not going to get you anywhere.
Right. So this is the problem that we have is in Muslim societies is that we have nifaq. We have people who understand that they can't openly come out and say anything against Islam. And I don't mean Islam as a historical matter. I'm talking about the wisdom, the rules, the basic beliefs.
Right.
Okay? Mm. They know that they can't do that because they would be socially shunned.
Quite.
They would be ostracized. Mm. And so they keep it in themselves. And you have this nifaq, which, again, I want to translate this hypocrisy, this fakeness, this falseness, this, you know, two-facedness, whatever you want to call it.
It's a disease.
It's a disease.
It's a disease of the soul, right?
And the most effective people that fight this are the people that have this personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam, which, you know, they recognize it and they fight it.
They fight it.
Immediately, mm-hmm. without any...
hesitation.
Right? Which, again, a prime example of that in our times is Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
We have examples of this. And in the series, we've talked about some of the examples before the revolution, during the revolution, beginning of the revolution, some of the problems that we had, some of the challenges that we had. I would like to point out to another one, which is more related to this issue, which is that after the revolution, the main issue, one of the basic reasons why there was even a revolution is the fact that, you know, we wanted Islamic law to be implemented.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
We want Sharia to be implemented as the laws of the land.
That's why you were called an Islamic republic.
Right. You can't have an Islamic society and an Islamic state if Sharia is not implemented.
Not implemented.
Now, this is a gradual process. This is a process that it's not, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. But the basic issue is this.
Sure.
This is what distinguishes an Islamic order from a non-Islamic order.
Exactly.
Okay, is Islamic laws, is ahkam, is the
rules
in the Quran and in the Riwayat as, you know, derived by the mujtahid, by the legal scholars in our time.
Yes.
Which is the Ja'fari school. This is our view, is that you have living mujtahids.
Mm-hmm.
You don't follow a mujtahid from 1,000 years ago or 500
years ago. No, you follow a living mujtahid.
You follow a living mujtahid who every generation looks at the Quran, looks at the Riwayat, looks at what he has, uses his aql. Aql is one of the
prerequisites.
One of
yes.
the things we use in Ja'fari fiqh.
Yes.
In terms of getting to, we even use aql to understand the Riwayat.
Exactly,
and the Quran.
Because
it's
we have the concept.
It's not that aql is, you know, opposed to the Riwayat.
No, it's not, because this rationalization is part of the methodology of this ijtihad, isn't it?
It's
part of human nature.
This is the way you figure out things.
Well,
this
God tells you to think.
This is the way humans figure out stuff.
Exactly.
They use their
this
logic.
Is where the humans figure out
right.
stuff.
This
That's
is why this is why
nice
we insist on having aql and rationalism in the Ahlul Bayt school, which some of the other schools, unfortunately,
no.
Have abandoned.
Because this is why logic is so part and parcel of the studies of this process.
Exactly.
Yes.
So,
Mantik, yes.
One of the things that happened after the revolution, which is what one of the main reasons that we even had the revolution, was to actually start implementing Islamic law.
Yes.
Now, this is where you can tell who is a munafiq and who isn't.
Quite.
Okay.
Very good.
This is the this is the dividing line.
This is the dividing line. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Mm. A lot of people, when it doesn't, when you're not, you know, when the rubber doesn't hit the road, when, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, hey, it's hey, we all love God, we all love the Prophet.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
Okay, now let's live according to the rules.
Yes, yes. And then suddenly,
you're like, hey, wait a second.
Wait a second. Yeah.
Million excuses. A thousand different, you know.
Well, I mean, this is why the Holy Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam had such a hard time in Medina. I mean, come on. 23 years was not just about revealing the Holy Quran. It was about you know, this implementation. And when it came to the implementation, we had all sorts of things happening.
Well, all I'm trying to say is that there were many people who, you know, obviously, you know, they don't deny God. They don't deny
God. I mean, this is...
Okay?
Yeah.
Who, when time came to live according to those rules, suddenly... Hey,
there were problems.
There were problems. Mm. One example was that you had a certain group which, you know, had the appearance of Islam, which was, you know, freedom movement and, you know, religious, you know, movements and people who were, who went to prayers and who fasted and all that. And then when Imam talked about implementing, you know, hudud and qisas, those punishments, those physical punishments that are part of Islamic law, which I will get to in a moment.
Please.
About why that's actually more civilized.
Yes.
Than
very good.
Sticking somebody in prison for no reason for years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. When that issue came up, you had so-called, you know, people who really thought they were Muslims saying, well, this goes against the Charter of the Human Rights, the UN Charter of Human Rights.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting.
So, what did Imam say? But this is when we're talking about the personality who is able to distinguish and who's able to, you know, deal with the nifaq, which is one of the main features of Islamic society. What did he say? He said, anybody who denies Islamic ahkam is a kafir.
There you have it. There you have it.
Now, you might say, well, isn't that harsh? Isn't that
something? No, I don't think that's...
Well,
harsh.
I'm saying people say that. They say, oh,
yeah,
no,
but
isn't that, don't you want to, you know...
Well, if you're a believer, you know, I mean...
Well, this is the point. There are certain... You know, we always talk about red lines, right?
Yes.
The whole, we're always talking about Iran's red lines and the West's red
lines.
But
yes, we do.
Isn't life about red lines?
It is. I think so,
right?
Very much so.
So, this is a red line.
This is a red line.
This is what distinguishes somebody who truly wants to follow the
Islam.
Prophet and the Quran.
Quran, yes.
And Islam as it's revealed.
Mm-hmm.
Not as I desire it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm including myself in this.
Of
don't think
we're
holier. We're not holier than thou.
No. We're not more Catholic than the Pope.
Right.
Right.
Each one of us, all of us, have things that their nafs, their inner, you know, animal self, will be like, no, that's not good. Why did God say that?
Mm.
And this is where you have to do jihad and nafs.
Exactly.
That's why it's called jihad enough.
That's the whole point. This is the jihad-e akbar that the Holy Prophet was talking about.
It's not vacation of the nafs.
No.
Right? It's jihad enough, right?
Of course. This is the discipline that we require.
Right. So there might be parts and obligations that I have as a Muslim, which are going to be a little bit difficult on me. But they're good for me. It says in the Quran a couple places, there might be things that, you know.
Yes, of course, that you're not happy with, that you will not like. But there's khair in it. There is,
okay. I'll give you an example,
please.
I'll give you an example for the
listeners,
for the men.
Yes.
In Islam, a man is legally obligated to take care of the expenses of his family.
Exactly.
His wife does not have to go work.
No.
She can if she wants to.
No, but that's a volunteer thing, isn't
right.
it?
Right. But you, as a husband,
you are wajib.
As a husband, as a father,
compulsory.
You have to make jihad.
You have to make jihad.
On a daily
and
basis.
It is called jihad in
Riwayat. It is a jihad.
It is called jihad. The word is used
it
like
is
that.
It is a jihad.
Yeah.
Okay, so don't think it's not a jihad.
No, in Bihar al-Anwar it is used
to
like that.
To get halal income for your family.
Exactly.
Yeah. We all know that, you know, some people, it's hard for them. They don't like it. They would rather stay home. They would rather go out with their friends. They would rather, you know, live in the mosque the whole day, right?
But that's not
what Allah wants from you.
That's not what Allah wants from you.
Look, I gave the example of the mosque. Now, not to think that we're talking about people who are bad people.
No.
Somebody who is very religious and says, you know what, I would rather just pray. That's not what Allah wants from you. If you have a wife, if you have children, you have to take care of them. It's wajib. And it might be hard for you.
This was exactly the issue which, you know, this term Sufi came about. You know, because, you know, Imam Ali alayhi salam saw somebody doing like that because he was trying to imitate Imam Ali because he was doing almost like 1,000 rak'ah per day. That's nice. But Imam Ali said, that's my job. But your job is to go out and work and feed your family.
Right.
That is part of your worship, part of your ibadah.
You do the things that are...
You do the things according to the way the Sharia is.
You said there's the wajib prayers.
There's the wajib, yes.
If you can do the mustahab ones as well,
that's
great.
Great, but that's...
That's mustahab.
That's mustahab, but your main...
Don't let the mustahab get in the way of the wajib.
Okay.
This is because we always...
That's exactly what I was trying to say.
Exactly. Because there's a problem with a lot of people. They have a problem. They don't understand this riwayat. They think it actually means don't let the mustahab ibadat get in the way of your wajib duties.
Duties.
Okay. It's not that, you know, don't pray the mustahab prayers.
When you have time, you can do that.
Right. When you have time. So you do all the wajib stuff during the day, which the main one being you take care of your family.
Family. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And it's not only the financial, it's also being the wali, being the guide, being the one that keeps the family together. That solves the problem, that, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not just about, you know, being a, you know, money-producing robot, which unfortunately has become the case.
It has become the case.
You know,
but it is more, you know, as you quite right, but this is part of our worship. This is the other thing. This is not something separate that,
so
you know.
Again, I would just like, the reason we went on this tangent was because, you know, there are certain things.
Mm.
You know, it's very... you fall into nifaq very easily.
Easily. That's
where
true.
You look at something and you're like, well, I'm sure these guys at that time who, you know, like I said, they prayed, they fasted, you know, they didn't deny God, they didn't deny the Prophet, they didn't deny Imam Ali alayhi salam, they didn't deny Imam Hussein. They're thinking, well, isn't it better for us if we don't do this now, if we don't have qisas and hudud? You know, maybe the Americans won't be so upset at us. Maybe the United Nations will, you know, pat us on the back and tell us, you're good boys. You know, we accept your revolution. Okay?
I mean, I think we
have... And this is where leadership is important.
Exactly. This is what I was going to get to. What is the leadership for, then, Islam?
So, Imam Khomeini just comes out. And he's, you know how he...
Yeah, I know. I remember
comes
that.
On,
this is why I loved
speech,
him.
He goes, anybody who denies... Islamic qisas hudud is a kafir.
Is a kafir. Thank you.
Case.
Thank you, sir.
Closed.
Case closed. That's right.
Case closed.
Closed. Finish.
Okay. Now, obviously, this is going to repel some people.
Of course, it is.
This is in the nature of things.
In the nature of things. Yeah.
Just as
it happened in Imam Ali's time.
Just as it happened with Imam Ali.
Exactly.
So we see Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him, who at this very, very important and
critical
sensitive
juncture,
and
yes.
critical juncture, and let me say this, and you know, you might be amazed, in human history.
Yes.
It wasn't simply Iranian history, Islamic
history.
No,
it's not nothing to do with
it. You know, because we talked about how this revolution was unique in human history. Okay? It was unique in human. Somebody has said, I mean, I don't completely agree with this, but this is an interesting way of putting it. He says, a traditional scholar... in the modern world, creating a postmodern revolution. Okay? Now, so, you know, at this critical juncture in human history where you have a nation awakening, the Iranian nation, you know, hoisting the banner of Islam after all those decades and
centuries
of
that have gone past,
right? This is the kind of man you need. We talked about the things that happened during the revolution, you know, with the different threats that were set to him, you know, the different political games that were being played. To get him to go to Qom and just be quiet.
Yes,
and let so-and-so take over and let this person do. So we get to the internal affairs. Internal affairs, like we said, it has to do with dealing with nifaq. The people that are saying these things to you, you know, on the surface of it, these are Muslims.
Mm.
They pray.
They pray.
They cry for Imam Hussein.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
They're not bad people. Bad people. You
know,
we always talk about, they're good people.
No.
it's everybody's good, obviously.
Obviously.
Right?
Yes.
The point is, to what extent do you really want to implement Islam?
Ah, this is the real question.
Right?
This is the
as
real
somebody
question.
Said, as one of the scholars said in one of the speeches, this was very nice. He said, you know, we have three kinds of people. And this is based on the Revayat from
yes,
Ahlul
it is.
Bayt.
Yeah, I'm aware of this.
Right?
Yes. Mm.
This is based on the Revayat from Ahlul Bayt.
Right, yes.
He said, we have those who are our enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Those for whom, I'm giving you the interpretation
of it.
It's not the direct.
Yes.
It's not those who love us but also have other affairs.
Those who love us and have other affairs, yes.
And then those whose lives, whose our affair is their life.
Our affair is their life.
Our program, our
everything is their life.
Their life is to implement, you know, this Islam.
This.
So this is the kind of, and you know, obviously we're talking about being the last type of person. We're not even talking about two people who are the enemies.
No.
The enemies, it's clear what the enemies are. We're not talking about that.
No.
We're talking about how do you deal with those who love Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
It's the old Kufin's story.
Kufin's story.
It's the
exactly
old people. Hey, you know, we love you, but we can't come with you.
Come with you to Karbala.
Right. We've got other things.
Yes. I mean, like one companion was asked, you know, to come with Imam Hussain. He said, "No, you can take my horse and my sword and this and that." And Imam said, "I don't want your horse and your."
I don't want that. I want you. I want you to go to heaven. Right?
Yes.
So, again, we're not saying we would pass this test.
We're not trying to say
that we're holier than anyone.
No.
But this is why it's important to have leaders and people like Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
Because in those critical junctures, in those moments where, hey, suddenly Shaitan is, you know,
yes, this is where he
attacking you from various sides.
This is where he does
his job. Making bad things look good.
Look good.
Because, you know, remember, the way Shaitan fools Mu'min people who are religious, is with religion.
With religion, yes.
With things they like.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a very small example.
Yes.
We like to pray on time,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're sitting in the mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And the prayer leader, for some reason, is a bit late.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he got stuck in traffic.
Yes.
Maybe somebody's asking him a question.
Mm-hmm.
And we get all excited. We get all angry. Oh, my God, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
And then we ruin our prayer. Right? We're not.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And the reason
how many times is that?
The reason why is because Allah, because, you know, we like prayer on time.
Right.
And Shaitan knows, okay, so I'm going to make him feel bad about it. I'm going to do something that with this very notion, his prayer is going to be for me, not for Allah.
Yes.
Or, you know, people who are very sensitive about tahara, you know, about being.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. And they just keep, and you're like, dude, it's punk. Just go pray. You know?
I mean, even Imam Ali alayhi salam used to throw water on his clothes just so there's no shuck.
Right. And that's the point. The point is, you know, Shaitan enters and makes you ruin the beautiful things that you're
exactly doing, exactly
with
so that you
things
don't miss
you like,
mm.
with things that are important to you.
Right.
It's your children, you know, the wealth you've worked for all your life.
Yes.
And this goes back to Zuhair ibn al-Qayn, you know.
Yes, exactly. This
you know who was the big prominent, you know, fat cat businessman,
mm-hmm.
Uthmani, you know, very close with the Uthmani administration,
sure.
Very wealthy, very prominent.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're traveling on the same route.
Yes, yes.
And
he's
constantly trying to
avoid Imam Hussain's camp.
And then finally, a messenger comes and says, look, you know, Prophet's son wants to see you.
See you.
He's like, well, I don't know. And his wife's like, listen.
You don't lose opportunities
right,
like
the Prophet's
this.
Son wants to
see you.
You better go.
Yeah.
And he goes,
mm.
and he gives away everything. He gives away all his wealth.
Yeah.
Everything. He says, you know what, that's it. So, you know, this is the... Shaitan, you know, is waswasing him. Is saying, look, you've got all this wealth, you've got status, you've got these wives, you've got this, you know.
There's a lot to lose.
You're this big shot.
You're
considered, you know, sheikh among the Arabs. Mm. You know, these are things that people like.
Yeah.
You know, and these are things in society that help him. And actually,
sure.
you know, they help his children having wealth and having,
sure.
you know.
Sure.
And what happens? In the end, Shaitan loses.
Alhamdulillah,
because he had something, he had a purity in his
heart. He had a purity in his heart.
Okay.
He was the one who came up with the best
and
line,
you know,
with Imam Hussain.
Exactly.
Like.
And you know what he said? This is in Shabal yes. al-Arshad. He said, and they asked him, they said, so what made you do it? He said, I remember that we were fighting with Salman, with the Prophet. We were fighting in the battle with the, you know, under the
mm.
banner of the Prophet. And
yes.
Salman told me that one day the Ibn Rasulullah, the son of the Rasul, will ask you to help him and fight with him, and you will. He said, I remembered that. And this is how many decades
mm.
before that, right?
Yes, that's right.
So there was that purity which he had in his youth
mm.
when he followed the Prophet and he fought with the Prophet. And
mm.
so when the time came as an old man after
yes.
Allah had given him
all these things, yes.
It didn't become a hijab for him.
Mm.
It didn't become a way for him to go to hell.
Oh.
It became a way for him to go to heaven.
Heaven.
And the beautiful thing is his wife... Because he comes back to her and he says, you know, I divorce you.
I divorce
you,
yes.
You can go.
Yes.
And you know what she says? She says, I was the one that told you to go. So, you know, the point is that wishy-washiness, gray area,
mm.
you know, we might think that we're being very, you know, smart when we do these things.
Mm.
We might think that we're being very, you know, sly and,
mm.
and you know.
I just pray that God gives us an opportunity to be like Zuhair.
Right. And I think this is a problem, especially in the Muslim societies. We think that being this kind of like playing both sides and you know, no, trying to speak out of both sides of our mouth, that this is some sort of politics, or this is some sort
of... In Scotland, we say we speak out of both of our cheeks.
Right. Right, so... And yet, we see that this is not the case.
Yeah.
There are times when it comes where you have to take a stand and say things the way they are.
Yes.
And you know, if people are going to curse you for it, they will curse you for it. Of but Allah is praising you for it.
Of course he will.
And Imam Khomeini was a person like that.
Yes.
You know, he taught us that. We saw it on a daily basis when there was war, when there was revolution, when there was pressure. Again, I remind the people of when, you know, Shevardnadze came as the foreign minister of the Soviet Union.
Oh, the Soviet Union.
You know, everybody telling Imam, you know, you got to wink at him and you got to, you know, be nice to him and maybe the Soviets can help us during the war and, you know, we're under pressure. Didn't put on his turban, came out with pajamas, didn't even say hi to him, and basically told him that your system is going to, you know, go to hell
in a handbasket. Yes.
And then he just got up in the middle of Shevardnadze's speech and said, I'm going to bed.
I'm going to bed.
Right? Why? Because Shevardnadze was a communist, was a person who was killing Afghans at that time, the army, the Soviet.
Yeah, Muslims, yes.
So, that's it. And Allah made us win and they lost.
Thank you, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on that note. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners, and I hope they benefited from what we've said today. And it just leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, may the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening,
and goodbye.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Sudan's transition to democracy has been disrupted by yet another coup. Last week, head of Sudan's ruling council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, announced a dissolution of the country's transitional government and declared a state of emergency. He cited political infighting for the decision, adding that the move was made to avoid a civil war. The military rounded up Sudan's top officials, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok.
This government, or this government that Burhan has overthrown, was a government that came about on the basis of an agreement that there would not be any elections, that there would not be a democratic transition. It's important to stress that when al-Bashir fell, the reason why the civilian parties were happy to enter into an agreement with the army is because they felt that if they went to elections, the Sudanese people would reject them and vote for Islamic-leaning parties, i.e. vote for the Islamists in a different form from al-Bashir. And therefore, these leftist parties that are the civilian parties that Burhan has overthrown, they were happy to prevent elections. They were happy to take 67% of parliament unelected. They were happy to agree to an extended transition period in order to avoid giving people a say in what they wanted.
Nearly a dozen protesters were killed in the demonstrations that ensued. But that didn't deter the Sudanese from calling for mass protests against the coup. General Burhan has expressed hope that a new prime minister would be chosen to form a government within a week. He also suggested that the ousted prime minister has been offered a chance to return to his position and select a new cabinet. The next government is expected to stay in power until an election in 2023. The protesters say the military isn't serious about handing over power to civilians, describing the council as an extension of the old regime. The coup in Sudan drew condemnation from the international community, with the United Nations Security Council adopting a unanimous declaration calling on the junta to restore the civilian government. The World Bank has halted financial aid to the African country, while the African Union suspended Sudan's membership in the bloc. Iran has also denounced the coup, saying the undemocratic removal of a part of the ruling system in the African country disregards the demands of the Sudanese people. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh raised the possibility of foreign interference in what led to the ouster of Sudan's civilian rulers. He referred to reactions from Israel, where he said some are openly expressing delight in the aftermath of the recent coup. That doesn't come as a surprise, as Sudan normalized ties with the regime last year under an agreement brokered by the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Sudan's top brass have also maintained good relationships with the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, but experts believe that seemingly close ties might not last long.
It's important to remember that the UAE are also allies with the leftist parties in Sudan. The UAE was part of brokering the agreement between the leftist parties and the army, and also the UAE is hesitant with regards to the army that Abdel Fattah Burhan leads, in that even if it is perhaps comfortable with Abdel Fattah Burhan, the army is still seen to be predominantly Islamist, the army is still seen to be predominantly conservative, the army is still predominantly against normalization of ties with Israel. Even if Abdel Fattah Burhan himself has been pushing normalization of ties with Israel, there is a worry in the UAE and in Egypt that if the army becomes stronger in Sudan once more, then Abdel Fattah Burhan will not last long, and it may well be that they go back to the more conservative trends that al-Bashir represented. And this is why it's important to stress that it is not a given that the UAE, Saudi, and Egypt will support this coup. It's not a given that they are lobbying on behalf of Abdel Fattah Burhan.
But it appears that the Sudanese are determined to continue their protests, as they have done in the past few years, until their demands are met.
Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, have been defying international calls for an end to their disastrous war in Yemen. The destructive military campaign that's triggered the world's worst humanitarian crisis has been ongoing since March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, most of them civilians, have been killed in airstrikes or by deadly diseases or hunger. Millions have been displaced. Yemen's economy is in tatters, and international aid can hardly make its way to those in severe need because of a Saudi blockade. Despite untold human suffering, Saudis and Emiratis keep pounding Yemen in a war that has achieved none of its stated goals. And the aggressors are absolutely intolerant of any form of criticism of what they are doing in Yemen. That was on full display this week as criticism of the devastating war by a Lebanese minister infuriated the kingdom and its allies, triggering angry reactions from them. Saudi Arabia and most members of the Saudi-led Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, namely the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait, summoned Lebanese ambassadors to their capitals. This after Lebanese Information Minister George Kordai called for an end to the futile military campaign against Yemen. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said in a statement that it handed the ambassador a memorandum protesting against the minister's, quote, offensive remarks.
They know they're in the wrong. They feel guilty. And they also feel a sense of impunity. They feel that no one should criticize them because they've got lots of money and other people don't. So, and you know, it's a very sensitive subject for them. What they're doing in Yemen is... If any other country had done it, they would have been condemned much more fiercely and much sooner by the other countries in the region and the world. But the Saudis think that they have a lock on the Arab world and the Islamic world and much of the Western world, so they really don't understand the criticism.
The Lebanese information minister said in the interview that the Saudi-led forces are pounding homes, villages, funerals, and weddings. Kordai also said that he believes that the popular Ansar Allah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. The Lebanese information minister is now finding himself at the center of a political storm for speaking his mind. This is because Lebanon has been trying to improve ties with Persian Gulf Arab states. Prime Minister Najib Mikati seems to be in damage control mode now. He said the interview was recorded before his cabinet was formed and was a personal opinion rather than official policy. The information minister, who is under pressure for his remarks against the devastating war in Yemen, says he stated his position with love as a human who feels Arab suffering. The humanitarian situation in Yemen is apocalyptic. The unbearable suffering of civilians in Yemen has been ongoing for several years. But no measure has been taken against the war, which has also been militarily backed by Western allies of Saudi Arabia. The war in Yemen had been planned to quickly achieve its goals, like reinstating former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi, who is a Saudi ally. But it has proved to be an embarrassing failure. Despite this, the invaders remain defiant and are not changing course. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Faced with international inaction, Yemenis have been left with no other option than retaliatory missile and drone attacks against Saudi targets.
Iran's capital, Tehran, hosted a meeting on its neighboring country, Afghanistan. The top diplomats of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Pakistan have attended the gathering in person, while the Chinese and Russian foreign ministers were present online. The UN chief also sent a message to the summit online.
We need to keep engaging to help move things in the right direction. Fourth, Afghans and the region also need a country that is secure, not one that is a haven for terrorism or a center for drug trafficking. This is vital to peace and stability in the region and around the world. Excellencies, these are all issues on which the region has a shared interest and on which all of us must speak with one voice. We can only achieve more stability with a united approach. Together, let us act with determination and without delay to help the people of Afghanistan and to secure a better future for all.
The Wednesday conference took place a week after the third meeting of the Moscow format consultations on Afghanistan was held in the Russian capital. The Tehran meeting is aimed at stepping up collaborations between Afghanistan's neighboring countries and creating lasting peace there. Iran has always strongly advised against the interference of foreigners in Afghanistan's affairs and respected the country's independence and territorial integrity. It has also urged the formation of an inclusive government in the country.
In Afghanistan, we are facing a situation that, in order to reach an acceptable point for all Afghans, we still have a long way ahead of us.
Amir Abdullahian said this is a joint press conference with the visiting Pakistani counterpart, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, in Tehran. He added that Iran was pursuing contacts with all neighbors to Afghanistan to make sure the utmost use of capacities was achieved at its border crossings for trade and humanitarian aid delivery. The United States is a major factor in the current mess in Afghanistan. The U.S. military led the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 in what it proclaimed was a war on terror, meant to eradicate the Taliban. 20 years on, in mid-August this year, the Afghan government and military collapsed in the face of the Taliban's swift advances on the ground, which many attribute to a hasty withdrawal of U.S.-led occupation forces from the country. The UN World Food Program says 3.2 million children under 5 are close to acute malnutrition. Afghanistan is now on the brink of bankruptcy. The U.S. has frozen $10 billion of the country's assets in a bid to bring poor and war-weary Afghans to their knees. The resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group on the back of the U.S. exit has created fresh security challenges for the Taliban-ruled country. It's believed that the presence of Daesh terrorists in Afghanistan perfectly serves the interests of Americans.
Well, yeah, Islamic State has been used by the US, as has Al-Qaeda inside Syria. So they use these proxies to destroy the stability of countries.
Afghanistan lies at the crossroads of South and Central Asia. It has been rocked by a series of terrorist attacks in recent weeks, which killed scores of people. Most of them were Shia worshippers. There are reports that in the months before the US-led coalition forces left the country, thousands of terrorists made their way to Afghanistan from Central Asia, North Caucasus, Pakistan, and China's Xinjiang region. Most of them were recruited by Daesh.
Every indication is that the US will try, which is why this inclusive government is needed to resist such abilities to drive a wedge in society.
These foreign terrorists slipped into the country under the nose of US and NATO forces. The American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but further fanned its flames.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also referred to as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spy master and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, target squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back to Saudi Arabia.
A psychopath with no empathy, doesn't feel emotion, never learned from his experience. And we have witnessed atrocities and crimes committed by this killer. And the warning I received, don't be in our proximity of any Saudi mission in Canada. Don't go to the consulate, don't go to the embassy. Said why? Said they dismembered the guy, they kill him. You are on the top of the list.
Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
Well, I would say that Mohammed bin Salman, the supposed Saudi crown prince, never really goes to school and learns any kind of lesson whatsoever. He got away with murdering Khashoggi in Turkey, and the Americans huffed and puffed, and the intelligence services said that he was most likely involved, that the Saudis were definitely involved, and nothing was done about it.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018. From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confine of its borders. As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions of announcing the reforms in the first place. In the meantime, Al-Jabri alleged in the interview that MBS had even mentioned his intention of assassinating Saudi Arabia's former King Abdullah, and that there's video evidence proving it.
That's what he said, whether he's just bragging or but he said that and we took it seriously.
Does this video recording still exist?
Yes. I know where it is it's now. I know there are two copies of that. I know where they are.
Well, the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is desperately afraid of Saad al-Jabri. Al-Jabri was in the Interior Ministry. He was the Interior Minister's right-hand man. And he knows where the bodies are buried and where the money went. He has been has stated, to my knowledge, that the king and his son, Mohammed bin Salman, have been dipping into the Saudi government funds more than what is being appropriated for them, which astonishingly is $800 million per month.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Letitia James, the New York Attorney General who oversaw the inquiry into sexual harassment claims against former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo that ultimately led to his resignation, declared her candidacy for Governor of New York on Friday, 29th of October, setting up a history-making high-profile matchup in the Democratic primary. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Katie Gluck. The piece is titled, Letitia James Declares Her Candidacy for New York Governor. Letitia James, the New York Attorney General who oversaw the inquiry into sexual harassment claims against former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo that ultimately led to his resignation, declared her candidacy for Governor of New York on Friday, 29th of October, setting up a history-making, high-profile match-up in the Democratic primary. She begins the campaign as Governor Kathy Hochul's most formidable challenger, and her announcement triggers a start to what may be an extraordinary competitive primary, a contest set to be shaped by issues of ideology, race, and region in a state still battling its way out of the pandemic. Her announcement comes at a volatile moment in state politics, a day after former Governor Andrew Cuomo was charged in a sexual misconduct complaint based on the account of one woman whose claim of sexual harassment were detailed in the Attorney General's report. That development, Letitia James said, validated the findings in our report, and to her allies it further cemented the case for her leadership. But it has also added fresh fuel to Andrew Cuomo's suggestion that her investigation was politically motivated, a message that may resonate with some of the voters who still view Andrew Cuomo favorably. I'm running for governor of New York because I have the experience, vision, and courage to take on the powerful on behalf of all New Yorkers, Letitia James wrote on Twitter as she released her announcement video on Friday. In the video, a narrator said that Ms. James was running for good-paying jobs, a healthcare system that puts people ahead of profits, to protect the environment, make housing more affordable, and lift up our schools in every neighborhood. The video did not mention Andrew Cuomo by name. Letitia James, a veteran Brooklyn politician and the first woman of color to be elected to statewide office in New York, is seeking to become the first black female governor in the country. Kathy Hochul, who is white, is the state's first female chief executive and the first governor in more than a century to have deep roots in western New York. The race may have even broader implications as a key barometer of the direction of the Democratic Party in the Biden era. Kathy Hochul of the Buffalo area was once known as a more conservative Democrat, but she has increasingly moved to the left. Letitia James, by turn, has plenty of connections to the relatively moderate Democratic establishment, but also has long-standing ties to the left-wing Working Families Party. It is not yet clear what issues she will use to differentiate herself politically from Kathy Hochul, but there is plainly the potential for vigorous clashes over how best to move the New York State and the Democratic Party forward. Her announcement came 2 days after the New York Times and other media outlets reported that she and her team had begun informing key political players of her intentions. Since she was first elected as a Working Families Party candidate nearly 20 years ago, Tish has been a courageous fighter for everyday New Yorkers, said Sochi Nameka, the state director of the New York Working Families Party. We expect that Tish will campaign with a clear progressive vision for New York. And meanwhile, Letitia James herself has tweeted, I'm running for governor of New York because I have the experience, vision, and courage to take on the powerful on behalf of all New Yorkers. Let's do this together. Ms. James enters the race with a record that has drawn acclaim from many liberals in the state. As Attorney General, she made headlines for suing the National Rifle Association, the NRA, investigating President Donald Trump, and presiding over the Andrew Cuomo inquiry, which was conducted by outside lawyers. I've sued the Trump administration 76 times, but who's counting? She deadpanned in the video. She appeared to make several allusions to Andrew Cuomo. I've held accountable those who mistreat and harass women in the workplace, no matter how powerful the offenders, she said at one point in the video. I've spent my career guided by a single principle, stand up to the powerful on behalf of the vulnerable, she said at another point in the video, to be a force for change. Letitia James's allies believe that she could assemble a powerful coalition that includes black voters of varying ideological views, a broad swathe of left-leaning voters who welcomed her probes of Andrew Cuomo, national donor interested in her history-making potential, and a base in the most vote-rich part of the state. She has deep connections to some Labour leaders. 2. John Samuelson, the international president of the Transport Workers Union, declared minutes after Letitia James's announcement that she will be a governor that working New Yorkers can trust. His union officially endorsed Letitia James a few hours later, the first union endorsement in the race for governor, a campaign noted. In recent weeks, Letitia James has moved to build out her political and fundraising teams, and she begins the contest with significant New York City connections after serving on the city council as a public advocate. She has also spent time traveling across New York in her official capacity and for purely political outings. And she and her team have sounded out donors, Labour leaders, and elected officials as she moved towards the bid. Her team has begun seeking commitments for early endorsements that could help her build momentum quickly. But Kathy Hochul begins the race with her own significant advantages. She has been racing to cement an overwhelming fundraising edge. Receptive donors are one of the many benefits of incumbency. She is likely to perform strongly upstate, and she has spent years building relationships on Long Island. Since becoming governor, Kathy Hochul has maintained a breakneck public schedule heavily concentrated in the five boroughs, working to shore up her downstate strength and tapping a lieutenant governor, Brian Benjamin, who hails from Harlem, New York. And she has already locked down significant institutional support from groups including the Democratic Governors Association and Emily's List, the fundraising powerhouse that backs female candidates who support abortion rights. She has been endorsed by county chairs across the state, the state Democratic chairman, and the president of the NAACP New York State Conference.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, importance of a guest. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. When Allah wills happiness and prosperity for a nation, He will bestow on them a gift. They asked, "What is that gift?" Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam replied, "A guest." That is true. Guest is a gift from Allah, a valuable and honorable gift. However, a material world in which all affections are lost has no value for a guest. It treats him as troublesome and strange and unwelcome. Brothers and sisters, there are certain values of Islam that are so strong and that are so, they're so Islamic in nature that giving up those values takes away blessings from our lives. And shying away from having guests or entertaining guests or welcoming guests is one of those blessings of Allah, that if we shy away from this blessing, other blessings are going to be taken away from our lives. It is part and parcel of the Islamic culture. And this new Islamic civilization is going to push for this revival of the Sunnah. You know, when you look at this, the lives of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, they welcomed guests. They would wait for their guests. They would become happy when they would receive guests. And so were their companions. They too were so keen on having guests. But in today's world, we see something different. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the importance of a guest. In this materialistic world that we live in today, guests have been, they've become a burden. Everybody, you know, or most of the people, they try to avoid having guests. And even the guests that they invite, it is with some ulterior motives in their mind. It is because of their dual motive, you know, for some personal gain or benefit that they want to achieve by inviting these guests. This is not Islamic lifestyle. It rarely happens that someone invites another or gets invited unless there is a selfish reason relating to business or wealth or politics. Isn't that unfortunate? It's completely opposite to the seerah and the lifestyles of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, and even their companions. You know, let's talk about those who were not, in that sense of the word, infallible. But they were so welcoming of their guests, they would become happy. Their faces would start to shine when they would receive guests. In Islamic countries and families in which religious customs are still alive, a guest is honored and respected as a divine gift, notwithstanding the absence of family relationship or any ulterior motives. You know, some of the companions, we have reports on this, that some of the companions of prophets and imams, if they wouldn't receive a guest at their house for a few days, they would come to the prophet and imam and they would say, "What is it that we are doing wrong that Allah is not sending those guests to our place?" See, they would become concerned. But in today's hustle bustle and this fast lifestyle, we don't have time for other believers to be our guests, unfortunately. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.